An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Chapter 3, Part 3. Section 2, State of the Evidence. Bacon is celebrated for destroying the credit of a method of reasoning much resembling that which it has been the object of this chapter to recommend. "He who is not practiced in doubting," he says, "but forward in asserting and laying down such principles as he takes to be approved, granted, and manifest, and according to the established truth thereof, receives or rejects everything, as squaring with or proving contrary to them, is only fitted to mix and confound things with words, reason with madness, and the world with fable and fiction, but not to interpret the works of nature." But he was aiming at the application of these modes of reasoning to what should be strict investigation, and that in the province of physics. And this he might well censure without attempting, what is impossible, to banish them from history, ethics, and religion. Physical facts are present, they are submitted to the senses, and the senses may be satisfactorily tested, corrected, and verified. To trust to anything but sense, in a matter of sense, is irrational. Why are the senses given us but to supersede less certain, less immediate informants? We have recourse to reason or authority to determine facts, when the senses fail us, but with the senses we begin. We deduce, we form inductions, we abstract, we theorize from facts. We do not begin with surmise and conjecture. Much less do we look to the tradition of past ages, or the decree of foreign teachers, to determine matters which are in our hands and under our eyes. But it is otherwise with history, the facts of which are not present. It is otherwise with ethics, in which phenomena are more subtle, closer, and more personal to individuals than other facts, and are not referable to any common standard by which all men can decide upon them. In such sciences, we cannot rest upon mere facts, if we would, because we have not got them. We must do our best with what is given us, and look about for aid from any quarter. And in such circumstances, the opinions of others, the traditions of ages, the prescriptions of authority, antecedent auguries, analogies, parallel cases, these and the like, not indeed taken at random, but like the evidence from the senses, sifted and scrutinized, obviously become of great importance. And further, if we proceed on the hypothesis that a merciful providence has supplied us with means of gaining such truth as concerns us in different subject matters, though with different instruments, then the simple question is what those instruments are which are proper to a particular case. If they are of the appointment of a divine protector, we may be sure that they will lead to the truth, whatever they are. The less exact methods of reasoning may do his work as well as the more perfect, if he blesses them. He may bless antecedent probabilities in ethical inquiries, who blesses experience and induction in the art of medicine. And if it is reasonable to consider medicine, or architecture, or engineering, in a certain sense, divine arts, as being divinely ordained means of our receiving divine benefits, much more may ethics be called divine. While as to religion, it directly professes to be the method of recommending ourselves to him and learning his will. If then it be his gracious purpose that we should learn it, the means he gives for learning it, be they promising or not to human eyes, are sufficient, because they are his, and what they are at this particular time, or to this person, depends on his disposition. He may have imposed simple prayer and obedience on some men as the instrument of their attaining to the mysteries and precepts of Christianity. He may lead others through the written word, at least for some stages of their course. And if the formal basis on which he has rested his revelations be, as it is, of an historical and philosophical character, then antecedent probabilities, subsequently corroborated by facts, will be sufficient, as in the parallel case of other history, to bring us safely to the matter, or at least to the organ, of those revelations. Moreover, in subjects which belong to moral proof, such I mean as history, antiquities, political science, ethics, metaphysics, and theology, which are preeminently such, and especially in theology and ethics, antecedent probability may have a real weight and cogency which it cannot have in experimental science. And a mature politician or divine may have a power of reaching matters of fact in consequence of his peculiar habits of mind, which is seldom given in the same degree to physical inquirers, who, for purposes of this particular pursuit, are very much on a level. And this last remark, at least, is confirmed by Lord Bacon, who confesses, "Our method of discovering the sciences does not much depend upon subtlety and strength of genius, but lies level to almost every capacity and understanding. Though surely sciences there are in which genius is everything and rules all but nothing." It will be a great mistake, then, to suppose that because this eminent philosopher condemned presumption and prescription in inquiries into facts which are external to us, present with us, and common to us all, therefore authority, tradition, verisimilitude, analogy, and the like, are mere idols of the den or of the theater in history or ethics. Here we may oppose to him an author in his own line, as great as he is. "Experience," says Bacon, "is by far the best demonstration, provided it dwell in the experiment, for the transferring of it to other things judged alike is very fallacious, unless done with great exactness and regularity." Niebuhr explains or corrects him. "Instances are not arguments," he grants, when investigating an obscure question of Roman history. "Instances are not arguments, but in history are scarcely of less force. Above all, where the parallel they exhibit is in the progressive development of institutions." Here, this sagacious writer recognizes the true principle of historical logic, while he exemplifies it. The same principle is involved in the well-known maxim of Aristotle that it is much the same to admit the probabilities of a mathematician and to look for demonstration from an orator. In all matters of human life, presumption, verified by instances, is our ordinary instrument of proof. And if the antecedent probability is great, it almost supersedes instances. Of course, as is plain, we may err grievously in the antecedent view which we start with. And in that case, our conclusions may be wide of the truth. But that only shows that we had no right to assume a premise which was untrustworthy, not that our reasoning was faulty. I am speaking of the process itself, and its correctness is shown by its general adoption. In religious questions, a single text of Scripture is all sufficient with most people, whether the well-disposed or the prejudiced, to prove a doctrine or a duty, in cases where custom is well established or a tradition is strong, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, is sufficient for establishing social, public, nay, Sunday worship. Where the tree falleth, there shall it lie, shows that our probation ends with life. Forbidding to marry determines the Pope to be the man of sin. Again, it is plain that a man's aftercourse, for good or bad, brings out the passing words or obscure actions of previous years. Then, on a retrospect, we use the event as a presumptive interpretation of the past, of those past indications of his character, which, considered as evidence, were too few and doubtful to bear insisting on at the time, and would have seemed ridiculous had we attempted to do so. And the antecedent probability is even found to triumph over contrary evidence, as well as to sustain what agrees with it. Everyone may know of cases in which a plausible charge against an individual was borne down at once by weight of character, though that character was incommensurate, of course, with the circumstances which gave rise to suspicion, and had no direct neutralizing force to destroy it. On the other hand, it is sometimes said, and even if not literally true, will serve in illustration, that not a few of those who are put on trial in our criminal courts are not legally guilty of the particular crime on which a verdict is found against them, being convicted not so much upon the particular evidence as on the presumption arising from their want of character and the memory of their former offences. Nor is it in slight matters only, or unimportant, that we thus act. Our dearest interests, our personal welfare, our property, our health, our reputation, we freely hazard, not on proof, but on a simple probability, which is sufficient for our conviction, because prudence dictates to us so to take it. We must be content to follow the law of our being in religious matters as well as in secular. But there is more to say on the subordinate position which direct evidence holds among the motiva of conviction in most matters. It is no paradox to say that there is a certain scantiness, nay, an absence of evidence, which may even tell in favor of statements which require to be made good. There are indeed cases in which we cannot discover the law of silence or deficiency, which are then simply unaccountable. Thus Lucian, for whatever reason, hardly notices Roman authors or affairs. Maximus Tyrius, who wrote several of his works at Rome, nevertheless makes no reference to Roman history. Paterculus, the historian, is mentioned by no ancient writer except Priscian. What is more to our present purpose, Seneca, Pliny the Elder, and Plutarch are altogether silent about Christianity, and perhaps Epictetus too and the Emperor Marcus. The Jewish Mishnah, too, compiled about A.D. 180, is silent about Christianity, and the Jerusalem and Babylonish Talmuds, almost so, though the one was compiled about A.D. 300 and the other A.D. 500. Eusebius, again, is very uncertain in his notice of facts. He does not speak of St. Methodius, nor of St. Anthony, nor of the martyrdom of St. Perpetua, nor of the miraculous powers of St. Gregory Thaumaturgus. And he mentions Constantine's luminous cross, not in his ecclesiastical history, where it would naturally find a place, but in his life of the emperor. Moreover, those who receive that wonderful occurrence, which is, as one who rejects it allows, so inexplicable to the historical inquirer, have to explain the difficulty of the universal silence on the subject of all the fathers of the 4th and 5th centuries excepting Eusebius. In like manner, Scripture has its unexplained omissions. No religious school finds its own tenets and usages on the surface of it. The remark applies also to the very context of Scripture, as in the obscurity which hangs over Nathaniel or the Magdalene. It is a remarkable circumstance that there is no direct intimation all through Scripture that the serpent mentioned in the temptation of Eve was the evil spirit, till we come to the vision of the woman and child, and their adversary the dragon, in the 12th chapter of the Apocalypse. Omissions, thus absolute and singular, when they occur in the evidence of facts or doctrines, are of course difficulties. On the other hand, not unfrequently they admit of explanation. Silence may arise from the very notoriety of the facts in question, as in the case of the seasons, the weather, or other natural phenomena, or from their sacredness, as the Athenians would not mention the mythological Furies, or from external constraint, as the omission of the statues of Brutus and Cassius in the procession. Or it may proceed from fear or disgust, as on the arrival of unwelcome news, or from indignation or hatred or contempt or perplexity, as Josephus is silent about Christianity, and Eusebius passes over the death of Crispus in his Life of Constantine. Or from other strong feeling, as implied in the poet's sentiment, "Give sorrow words." Or from policy, or other prudential motive, or propriety, as Queen's speeches do not mention individuals, however influential in the political world, and newspapers, after a time, were silent about the cholera. Or again, from the natural and gradual course which the fact took, as in the instance of inventions and discoveries, the history of which is on this account often obscure. Or from the loss of documents or other direct testimonies, as we should not look for theological information in a treatise on geology. Again, it frequently happens that omissions proceed on some law, as the varying influence of an external cause. And then, so far from being a perplexity, they may even confirm such evidence as occurs, by becoming, as it were, its correlative. For instance, an obstacle may be assignable, person or principle or accident, which ought, if it exists, to reduce or distort the indications of a fact to that very point, or in that very direction, or with the variations, or in the order and succession, which do occur in its actual history. At first sight, it might be a suspicious circumstance that but one or two manuscripts of some celebrated document were forthcoming. But if it were known that the sovereign power had exerted itself to suppress and destroy it at the time of its publication, and that the extant manuscripts were found just in those places where history witnessed to the failure of the attempt, the coincidence would be highly corroborative of that evidence which alone remained. Thus it is possible to have too much evidence, that is, evidence so full or exact as to throw suspicion over the case for which it is adduced. The genuine epistles of St. Ignatius contain none of those ecclesiastical terms, such as priest or see, which are so frequent afterwards, and they quote Scripture sparingly. The interpolated epistles quote it largely. That is, they are too scriptural to be apostolic. Few persons, again, who are acquainted with the primitive theology, but will be skeptical at first reading of the authenticity of such works as the Longer Creed of St. Gregory Thaumaturgus, or St. Hippolytus Contra Baronum, from the precision of the theological language, which is unsuitable for the ante-Nicene period. The influence of circumstances upon the expression of opinion or testimony supplies another form of the same law of omission. "I am ready to admit," says Paley, "that the ancient Christian advocates did not insist upon the miracles in argument so frequently as I should have done. It was their lot to contend with notions of magical agency against which the mere production of the facts was not sufficient for the convincing of their adversaries. I do not know whether they themselves thought it quite decisive of the controversy. But since it is proved, I conceive with certainty that the sparingness with which they appealed to miracles was owing neither to their ignorance nor their doubt of the facts. It is at any rate an objection, not to the truth of the history, but to the judgment of its defenders." And in like manner, Christians were not likely to entertain the question of the abstract allowableness of images in the Catholic ritual, with the actual superstitions and immoralities of paganism before their eyes. Nor were they likely to determine the place of the Blessed Mary in our reverence, before they had duly secured in the affections of the faithful the supreme glory and worship of God incarnate, her eternal Lord and Son. Nor would they recognize purgatory as a part of the dispensation till the world had flowed into the church, and a habit of corruption had been largely superinduced. Nor could ecclesiastical liberty be asserted till it had been assailed. Nor would a pope arise but in proportion as the church was consolidated. Nor would monachism be needed while martyrdoms were in progress. Nor could St. Clement give judgment on the doctrine of Berengarius, nor St. Dionysius refute the Ubiquists, nor St. Irenaeus denounce the Protestant view of justification, nor St. Cyprian draw up a theory of toleration. There is a time for every purpose under the heaven, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Sometimes, when the want of evidence for a series of facts or doctrines is unaccountable, an unexpected explanation or addition in the course of time is found as regards a portion of them, which suggests a ground of patience as regards the historical obscurity of the rest. Two instances are obvious to mention of an accidental silence of clear primitive testimony as to important doctrines and its removal. In the number of the articles of Catholic belief which the Reformation especially resisted were the Mass and the sacramental virtue of ecclesiastical unity. Since the date of that movement, the shorter epistles of St. Ignatius have been discovered, and the early liturgies verified. And this, with most men, has put an end to the controversy about those doctrines. The good fortune which has happened to them may happen to others, and though it does not, yet that it has happened to them, is to those others a sort of compensation for the obscurity in which their early history continues to be involved. I may seem, in these remarks, to be preparing the way for a broad admission of the absence of any sanction in primitive Christianity in behalf of its medieval form. But I do not make them with this intention. not from misgivings of this kind, but from the claims of a sound logic, I think it right to insist that whatever early testimonies I may bring in support of later developments of doctrine are in great measure brought ex abundante, a matter of grace, not of compulsion. The onus probandi is with those who assail a teaching which is and has long been in possession. As for positive evidence in our behalf, they must take what they can get. If they cannot get as much as they might wish, inasmuch as antecedent probabilities, as I have said, go so very far towards dispensing with it. It is a first strong point that in an idea such as Christianity, developments cannot but be, and those surely divine, because it is divine. A second, that, if so, they are those very ones which exist, because there are no others. And a third point is the fact that they are found just there, where true developments ought to be found, namely, in the historical seats of apostolical teaching, and in the authoritative homes of immemorial tradition. And if it be said in reply that the difficulty of admitting these developments of doctrine lies not merely in the absence of early testimony for them, but in the actual existence of direct testimony against them, or, as Chillingworth says, in Popes Against Popes, Councils Against Councils, I answer, of course this will be said. But let the fact of this objection be carefully examined, and its value reduced to its true measure, before it is used in argument. I grant that there are bishops against bishops in church history, fathers against fathers, fathers against themselves. For such differences in individual writers are consistent with, or rather are involved in, the very idea of doctrinal development, and consequently are no real objection to it. The one essential question is whether the recognized organ of teaching, the Church herself, acting through Pope or Council as the oracle of heaven, has ever contradicted her own enunciations. If so, the hypothesis which I am advocating is at once shattered. But till I have positive and distinct evidence of the fact, I am slow to give credence to the existence of so great an improbability. End of Part 3 of Chapter 3. End of Chapter 3.